I suspect that many people think the Nazi war criminals were convicted and hanged because of the testimony of the Jews who were in those concentration camps against them. This is a mistaken impression. The testimony of the survivors of the death camps was important, but it was not the most damning testimony against them. The survivors of the death camps could have been perhaps dismissed as witnesses, being biased, being after revenge because maybe of the way they were treated, maybe they were not entirely honest. One might, if you really took a stretch, come to a conclusion like that. But the most damning evidence at Nuremberg was the Nazis' own meticulous record-keeping. Robert Conant wrote a book, Justice at Nuremberg. It was written a long time ago. I have very little doubt, though, that it's still in print and can still be gotten rather easily. I strongly recommend it to those who are reading Bent because of the background, the information, the knowledge, and the total destruction of any idea that the Holocaust did not take place. Conant said, "No one who has experienced the trial or become familiar with the evidence and record can doubt that the case was proved conclusively, that despite all the horrors that were brought to light, it was, if anything, understated." That last sentence, I need to repeat that. Despite all the horrors that were brought to light, it was, if anything, understated. None of the defendants attempted to refute the evidence. They sought instead to explain away their own participation and to shift the blame to others. Not only were the documents the prosecution introduced the Nazis' own words, mind you, the documents were the Nazis' own words. The witnesses, both for the prosecution and the defense, included some of the highest officials in Hitler's government. Far from denying what had taken place, each contributed additional information to the litany of murder. And these were people, these were not Jews, these were high up, high ranking Germans. Dieter Wislinski, one of Eichmann's half dozen deputies, provided a detailed accounting of the 5,250,000 Jews who had been exterminated. Otto Ohlendorf, the chief of Hitler's internal intelligence division, commander of an Einsatzgruppe in Russia, testified to the slaughter of Jews in the East. Rudolf Hess, commander of Auschwitz, related the 3 million people, most of them Jews, had perished in his concentration camp, and he, most assuredly, was an authoritative witness. Erich von Damm-Bach-Zalewski, the chief of the anti-partisan forces, confessed to the indiscriminate extermination of the innocent. It was not as if the evidence was circumstantial or depended upon secondary witnesses. It was direct and damning. Let there be no doubt. He says it was not circumstantial. It did not depend on secondary witnesses. It was direct and damning. Now, I'm not sure what it is about men like this, about people who are so evil, that cause them and make them want to maintain such good records of what they have done. In the words of the psalmist, they weigh the violence of their hands. You know, there is an idea that has been put forward, and I think it may be true, that they actually felt in their heart of hearts that they were doing the best thing for the world. And in the times to come, men would actually applaud them for getting rid of these people, these inferior persons, the homosexuals, the Jews, the gypsies, and that whole range of human detritus as they saw it. And they were actually probably preserving for posterity the violence that they had done with the idea that it was good. Having taken a good hard look at the evidence myself, you can really push one of my hot buttons by trying to deny the Holocaust to me. Because I have not merely just taken what I've heard or read in the newspapers. I have read, I have studied, I have listened, I have watched. And I personally have no patience with Holocaust deniers, not even for a moment. You would do well to give me a wide berth if that is your persuasion. Justice Jackson, in his opening address to the tribunal, remarked, "What makes this inquest significant is that these prisoners represent sinister influences that will lurk in the world long after their bodies have returned to the dust." That's another sentence that bears repeating. Justice Jackson, what makes this inquest significant is that these prisoners represent sinister influences that will lurk in the world long after their bodies have returned to the dust. And to that, Conan remarked, these influences, in fact, have regenerated like a poisonous weed. And I must add, they always will, in this world, under this system. Failure to recognize this is dangerous in the extreme. As one of the Psalms put it, the wicked walk on every side when the vilest men are exalted. And it's hard for me to think of men more vile than Adolf Hitler, Eichmann, Hess, Saddam Hussein, and we could go on with a litany of people in the modern world and the violence that they have done to people, the way in which they have stomped all over the faces of the poor, and the way they have murdered the innocent. That poisonous weed is always here. It always will be in this world, and I'm afraid some people just don't get it. All this came to mind to me when I was reading the 58th Psalm recently in a part of a project that I'm involved with of reading all the Psalms and some commentary onto tape. The 58th Psalm begins this way. Do you indeed speak righteousness, O congregation? Do you judge uprightly, O you sons of men? Yea, in heart you work wickedness. You weigh the violence of your hands in the earth. Two things that were striking to me about that when I came across it. I hit it and I thought, good grief, look at what he just said. They weigh the violence of their hands. That's what the Nazis were doing with their record keeping and all the stuff that they put together of what they had done. The other thing that hit me was they work wickedness in heart. These are not well-intentioned people who just get misled and go down the wrong path and make a mistake. These are not people who meant well. They may have had some perverted idea of what well was, but they had no intention of doing good to anybody, not really. They were evil right from the beginning, and they worked wickedness in heart. Then the psalm goes on to say this, the wicked are estranged from the womb. They go astray as soon as they are born, speaking lies. Now that's one of the most disturbing things I've read in the psalm so far. The wicked go astray or estranged from the womb. As soon as they are born, they go astray, speaking lies. What are we supposed to make of that? And it's disturbing to me, not because it's counter to experience, but precisely because it's not counter to experience, as we see in the world. I can't explain it, but the die seems to be cast on some children almost from the start. Is it that poisonous weed that Robert Conant talked about? He goes on to talk about it in verse 4. He says, they're poisonous like the poison of a serpent. They are like the deaf adder that stops her ear, which will not hearken to the voice of charmers charming never so wisely. What an incredible thing. First, the idea that it is a snake is important. And the next one is it is like a deaf adder that you can charm certain snakes with the flute. But this snake cannot be charmed. You can't turn it aside. You can't turn it back. And what this began to say to me, and it was frightening as I read through that psalm and some others, is that there are people in this world who are the wicked, who are irredeemable. Now, you should understand something. The psalms use two different words for sinners and the wicked. The people who are called sinners, the Hebrew word for that basically means the people like you and I, who through weakness or whatever in our lives have committed sins. There's another word, though, for the wicked. And it talks about people who are morally corrupt. And the implication here is that you have two kinds of people. One, the ordinary garden variety type of sinner, and the other one, the wicked. And whenever the Bible begins to speak of the wicked, you have to realize you are dealing with something other than normal human evil. There is human evil. And there is also an evil that is not human, that is abroad in the world, what he called that poisonous weed. I don't like it, this. I really don't. But what this is telling us is that there are some people who are wicked and who are irredeemable. I don't like it, but I have to face up to it. Some children are doomed early in their lives beyond any remedy in this life. Whether it's the parents or the devil or something else entirely, It happens. And we are better off facing that reality than we are trying to deny it because it doesn't feel good. I worried about this when I read the psalm on tape because of parents who have taken it on themselves to kill their own children because they thought the devil was in the child. A difficult child is not wicked, and it isn't up to parents to decide this in any case. But unless we understand something about this, we're going to find many things that we read in the Old Testament absolutely incomprehensible. We will simply not be able to understand how a good God could tell Saul to go down and wipe out the Amalekites, man, woman, and child, destroy all their animals and everything else. We won't be able to understand that unless we can get our mind around what I'm talking about today. The psalm goes on, for example, to say this, verse 6, "Break their teeth, O God, in their mouth. Break out the great teeth of the young lions, O Lord. Let them melt away as waters which run continually. When he bends his bow to shoot his arrows, let them be as cut in pieces. As a snail which melts, let every one of them pass away, like the untimely birth of a woman, that they may not see the sun. Before your pots can feel the thorns, he shall take them away as with a whirlwind, both living and in his wrath. The righteous shall rejoice when he sees the vengeance. He shall wash his feet in the blood of the wicked." So that a man may say, "Verily, there is a reward for the righteous. Verily, there really is a God that judges the earth." You know what he's talking about? He's talking about the fact that the righteous need to be able to say with confidence, God really does make a difference when it comes to wicked people and righteous people. So that we can actually say there is a God, he is just, and he does execute judgment. Now, I need to say this. The wicked deserve everything that it talks about in the Bible happening to the wicked. And some of the stuff is pretty tough. Now, this is one of those psalms people have a hard time reconciling with. We like to believe that all men are redeemable. You know, that we should be able somehow or other to bring everybody back from the brink. In this life, sometimes that's not possible. We'd like to believe there is no such thing as someone who is incorrigibly wicked. And it's one of the rationales of those people who are opposed to the death penalty. The problem, though, is that the Bible is remarkably single-minded when it comes to that category of people that the Bible calls, quote, the wicked. Take, for example, the 10th Psalm. "Why do you stand far off, O Lord? Why do you hide yourself in time of trouble? The wicked in his pride does persecute the poor. Let them be taken in the devices that they have imagined. For the wicked," what's he like? What kind of person is this wicked person? "He boasts of his heart's desire. He blesses the covetous whom the Lord abhors. The wicked, through the pride of his countenance, will not seek after God." Notice, doesn't say does not seek after God. It says he will not seek after God. God is not in all of his thoughts. His ways are always grievous. Your judgments, God, are far above out of his sight. As for all of his enemies, he puffs at them. He has said in his heart, "I shall not be moved. I shall never be in adversity." What you're reading here is a description of a severe sociopath. Somebody who has no idea the consequences might entail upon what he does. A person who commits evil with no regrets. A person who can grind the face of the poor and never have a moment's conscience or never lose a minute of sleep over it at night. His mouth is full of cursing and deceit and fraud. Under his tongue is mischief and vanity. He sits in the lurking places of the village. In the secret places, he murders the innocent. He is a killer, a remorseless killer. Whatever it takes to satisfy whatever desire he may have, be it for money, for power, or anything else, he has no compunction in deceit, in grinding the faces of the poor, murdering the innocent. None of these things bother them in the least. His eyes are privily set against the poor. He lies in wait secretly like a lion in his den. He lies in wait to catch the poor. And then he catches the poor when he draws him into his net. It seems as though the poor are a singular objective of the wicked. He crouches and humbles himself that the poor may fall by his strong ones. He has said in his heart, "God has forgotten. He hides his face. He will never see it." Arise, O Lord, O God, lift up your hand. Don't forget the humble. Why does the wicked condemn God? He has said in his heart, you will not require it, but you have seen it. You behold mischief and spite to requite it with your hands. The poor commits himself to you, and you are the helper of the fatherless. Break thou the arm of the wicked and the evil man. Seek out his wickedness until you don't find any. The Lord is king forever and ever. The heathen are perished out of his land. Lord, you have heard the desire of the humble. You will prepare their heart. You will cause your ear to hear, to judge the fatherless and the oppressed, that the man of the earth may no more oppress. So now we know. This is what the wicked is. And this is why he deserves everything he gets from God. It's why he deserves to be destroyed. It's why he deserves to have his teeth broken out, his kneecaps busted, everything else bad that you can think of that God could have done to him. He deserves every bit of it richly. He is a total sociopath, to use the modern term. And it's why in Jeremiah 48, and we don't need to turn to one verse, it's a fascinating little statement. He says, cursed be he that does the work of the Lord negligently. Cursed be he that holds back his sword from blood. When the time comes and God actually sends a person who is in authority to get a job done, he says, cursed is he that does the work of the Lord negligently and holds back his sword from blood. You want a biblical example? There came a time when Samuel came to Saul and said, the Lord spoke to me. He said, I want you to go down there and I want you to deal with the Amalekites. I want you to kill them all. Man, woman, child, ox, ass, everything that is there. Destroy it. Saul goes down, kills off some of the men, keeps some women, I think, for slaves, keeps Agag, the king of Amalekites, alive, and so forth, and says to Samuel when he comes, well, I have done, kept the commandment of the Lord. For whatever reason, what they had done was to destroy the things that were bad and kept for themselves the things that were good. And, of course, the rest of it is that's when Saul was rejected by God, because he was given a task that, frankly, you and I would have an awful hard time carrying out. We really would. But he said, cursed is he that does the work of the Lord negligently, because when the time comes that the wicked must be dealt with, if those who are in authority don't deal with the wicked, rest of God's people are going to suffer terribly in time to come, as history has certainly said. Saul fell under this curse in his day, and it stayed with his children till their dying day. The expression at the end of this psalm, that the man of earth may no longer oppress, evokes another memory of mine. It's found in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. Now, in this particular passage, Paul is trying to correct a mistake, I guess he thought he made, or a misunderstanding that arose out of his first epistle. People who read the first epistle thought Paul seemed to be saying that Christ was coming right away and that maybe we need to get ready for his imminent coming. Paul is trying to straighten that out. He says, now I beseech you, brethren, by the coming of our Lord Jesus Christ and by our gathering together to him, don't be shaken in mind, don't be troubled by spirit or word or letter as it was from us, that the day of Christ is at hand. Let no man deceive you by any means, for that day shall not come except there come a falling away first, and that man of sin be revealed, the son of perdition. The man of sin, the son of destruction, he is called. So we have somewhere between Paul and the end time, this fellow has got to come on the scene, a man of sin, like the man of the earth that he talks about back here, who is a wicked person, wicked to the core, irredeemably wicked, unrecoverable in any way, and he's going to have to be dealt with. Now, what about this guy? What's this fellow going to be like? He opposes and exalts himself above all that is called God, all that is worshiped, so that he, as God, sits in the temple of God, showing himself that he is God. Now, don't you remember when I was with you, I told you this? And now you know what withholds that he might be revealed in his time. For the mystery of iniquity is already at work. Only he who now hinders or lets or holds back will do so until he be taken out of the way. I don't know how many volumes have been written on what this passage means. I'm not going to attempt to explain it today. But then shall that wicked be revealed, whom the Lord shall consume with the spirit of his mouth and shall destroy with the brightness of his coming. So this is something, I guess, that we have to look forward to, if that's the term for it. That in our future, there is someone, a man called that wicked, a man of sin, an oppressor, whom the Lord will destroy with the brightness of his coming. Even him whose working is after the power of Satan, with all power and signs and lying wonders, and with all deceivableness of unrighteousness in them that perish, because they received not the love of the truth, that they might be saved. And for this cause God shall send them strong delusion, that they should believe a lie. Now, why in the world would God do a thing like that? Well, he answers it. That they all might be damned who believe not the truth, but have pleasure in unrighteousness. The people who are going to be to fall are the people who refuse to recognize the wicked for what he is. They simply cannot accept what they see with their own eyes, and they feel like they've got to find some other kind of explanation for what he has done. It's a fascinating book that deserves a read. The title is Explaining Hitler. I can't remember the author's name at the moment. We have a review of it on our website. Really very interesting read, because it's not so much about explaining Hitler, it's about the people who attempt to explain Hitler. And basically what he comes to in the book, it seems to me, although he never really gives his own conclusion, is that Hitler defies explanation, that any explanation of Hitler tends to mitigate what he has done, and what he has done must not be mitigated. He is the epitome of the wicked, as the Bible describes the wicked. And it's a shame that he was never brought to justice and never tried and hanged along with the rest of those criminals when the time came for that to happen. Psalm 36 is of interest in this regard. The transgression of the wicked says within my heart that there is no fear of God before his eyes. Just dead afraid of God. In fact, the wicked doesn't seem to be afraid of much of anything. He's not afraid of his enemies. He's not afraid of the law. He's not afraid of people, not afraid of masses. He is a man who, without any conscience, accumulates power to himself and exerts that power by whatever means are at hand. He flatters himself in his own eyes until his iniquity be found to be hateful. The words of his mouth are iniquity and deceit. He has left off to be wise. He has left off to do good. He devises mischief upon his bed. Now, you got to think about this. This is a person who can't even sleep at night because he has to lie awake thinking of what bad things he's going to do tomorrow. I'm afraid most of us ordinary sinners lie awake at night trying to figure out how we're getting out from under what we did yesterday. Not this guy. Never crosses his mind. He's busy devising tomorrow's mischief. He sets himself in a way that is not good. He abhors not evil. Now, as I read this and think about what I've read, it has a final quality to it, if you know what I'm meaning. Here's a person who, as it describes his character, it sounds very much like we're describing a person whose character is set in concrete. That the mechanisms for repentance or for change are completely absent from this person. The ability to recognize wrong, the ability to feel guilt, the ability to feel even fear of some higher authority. All these things are completely absent from this person. We are not talking about a normal, everyday human being when we're talking about the wicked. It is something completely foreign to us. None of us are like this. We probably feel guilty sometimes. We read the Psalms and hear what God says about the wicked. But the truth is, he's not talking about us. There are other Psalms that will talk about us and our weaknesses and our mistakes. When he talks about the wicked, this is somebody where he is beyond redemption. Though the wicked are, it's as though the wicked are set in their ways and will not return. Not that they cannot. They will not. Because the mechanism is not in them to even see the need for such a thing. And it occurs to me that there is such a thing as fixed wickedness, for which there is no remedy except destruction. And it is an understanding this, I think, that a lot of passages in the Psalm that people look at and say, ooh, what a bloody God that was in the Old Testament. I want to serve the God of the New Testament, not the God of the Old Testament. And they don't realize. They have never come to grips with the concept, with the idea, the realization that there are people in this world who are so wicked and irredeemably so and incorrigibly so that there is no remedy for them. The only remedy is for society, and that's the destruction of the wicked. It's the only way I can understand some of the events of the Old Testament, because of what God told Saul and others to do. They had to deal with this. They weren't just talking about good people who went bad. They're talking about settled evil. And I think this is a hard thing to grasp. But is it something that's likely to happen for a person to be a good person all the way through his teens, good kid, and get through high school and into college and still is a good kid, make good grades and a normal, ordinary, everyday person, and then somehow when he becomes 28, 29, 30, turn into an evil monster? I don't think that happens. There may be some mental illness that would create it, but I don't think that routinely happens to create a wicked person. I think it is something that is set in some people much earlier. I don't have the answer to that, in case you're thinking about coming up and asking me when I think it takes or how it works. I don't know. What I'm just telling you is that it is, and it's true, and when the psalm says the wicked go astray as soon as they are born, I have to accept that as a truth, not only because the Bible says it, because I think history also attests to it as well. Exodus chapter 20, a good old familiar scripture, says, "You shall not make unto you any graven image nor any likeness of anything that's in heaven above or in earth beneath. It's in the water under the earth. You shall not bow down yourself to them nor serve them. For I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children to the third and fourth generation of them that hate me." Now, I'm sorry. I read this and I can't come to any other conclusion. But what you could be a third generation kid sitting under a curse because of your father and your grandfather. It's in that book, staring in the face and hard to get away from. I don't know whether that explains what happens in the Psalms where it says the wicked go astray as soon as they are born, but you have to take it into consideration. There is the proverb, chapter 22, verse 6, "Train up a child in the way he should go, and when he is old, he will not depart from it." Boy, it puts a tremendous burden on parents. I don't think God expects parents to do the impossible, but I do think he expects them to give an awfully good shot at it, and I have to consider that when I read this proverb, I have to consider that the things parents do make a difference in the way their children are going to go. I can't get away from it. And therefore, when we have wickedness turning up in children who later on become sociopaths, the parents have got to carry some of that load themselves. There is a story of Ahab. It's found in 1 Kings chapter 21. And I always think this is a fascinating illustration and one that's very much worth hanging on to in your mind for several reasons. The word of the Lord came to Elijah the Tishbite, 1 Kings 21, 17. "Get down and meet the king of Israel, which is in Samaria. Behold, he is in the vineyard of Naboth, where he has gone to possess it. And you're going to speak to him and say this, 'Thus saith the Lord, have you killed and taken possession?'" This is the situation where he wanted that man's vineyard and the man wouldn't sell it to him, so Jezebel had him killed. He said, here's your gift, go down and take the land. He said, "You shall speak to him, saying, 'Thus saith the Lord, in the place where the dogs licked the blood of Naboth, shall dogs lick up your blood, even yours.' Ahab said to Elijah, 'Have you found me, O mine enemy?' He answered, 'I have found you, because you have sold yourself to work evil in the sight of the Lord.'" Under what circumstances would a prophet of God be your enemy? We know what it was in this case. "Behold, I will bring evil upon you and take away your posterity. I will cut off from Ahab him that pisseth against the wall and him that is shut up and left in Israel, and will make your house like the house of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, like the house of Baasha, the son of Ahijah, for the provocation wherewith you have provoked me to anger and made Israel to sin." What he is basically saying is, you have stuck a stick in my eye. You have provoked me, and there are consequences coming down from this. "And of Jezebel spoke the Lord, saying, 'The dog shall eat Jezebel by the wall of Jezreel. Him that dies of Ahab in the city, the dog shall eat. Him that dies in the field shall the fowls of the air eat.'" And then it makes this statement about Ahab. "There was none like Ahab, who did sell himself to work wickedness in the sight of the Lord, whom Jezebel his wife stirred up." Okay, you have got the worst of a bad lot in Ahab. But listen to what happens here. "He did very abominably in following idols, according to all things as did the Amorites, whom the Lord cast out from before the children of Israel. And it came to pass, when Ahab heard these words, He rent his clothes, put sackcloth upon his flesh, and fasted and lay in sackcloth and went softly. Instead of going around the clattering around the palace with everybody going ahead and blowing the trumpet and making a lot of noise, here comes Ahab in soft slippers, carefully, quietly making his way around. And the word of the Lord came to Elijah the Tishbite, saying, look at that. Do you see how Ahab humbles himself before me? Because he humbles himself before me, I will not bring the evil in his days, but in his son's days, I will bring the evil on his house. Now here's where we have to pause for a moment and consider what that psalm said. The wicked are estranged from the womb. They go astray as soon as they're born, speaking lies. As I said earlier, it may be possible that a child is under a curse from his parents and his grandparents. But think about this one. Even Ahab was able to repent. As much as I can see in the Psalms, fixed evil that is irredeemable, Ahab managed to repent when the prophecy came to him. And I have to ask myself, okay, God passed it on down to his sons, having looked at his sons, I suppose, and knowing what they were. Do you suppose that if Ahab's sons had repented, that the curse would have passed on beyond them to grandsons, and they wouldn't have had to bear it? And if the grandchildren had repented, that the curse would have not passed on, but would have expired? I think so. I think so. But at the same time, it is not something, what Ahab did is not something that happens very often. There's one more element in all this that I think has to be considered. There is a very real evil in this world that is human evil, but there is also a very present evil in the world that is not human. Daniel chapter 10, there is this fascinating story of Daniel who's been fasting and praying and asking God for word of what he is doing. And then finally, on the 24th day of the first month, Daniel 10 verse 4, as I was by the great river Hiddekel, I lifted up my eyes and I looked and behold a certain man clothed in linen whose loins were girded with fine gold of Uphaz. His body was like beryl, his face as the appearance of lightning, his eyes like a lamp of fire, his arms and his feet in color like polished brass, and the voice of his words like the voice of a multitude. Whoa. Is there any question what we got here? We have a huge, powerful spirit being who has come into Daniel's presence. Daniel says, I'm the only one that saw the vision, but a great quaking fell on everybody else, I can imagine. So they fled off to hide themselves, and I was alone. I saw this great vision, and there remained no strength in me. I can dare say he would have had weak knees. He said, but I heard the voice of his words, and as I was in a deep sleep on my face toward the ground, a hand touched me and set me upon my knees in the palms of my hands. And he said to me, O Daniel, a man greatly beloved, understand the words that I speak unto you, and stand upright, for now unto you I am sent. And when he had spoken this word unto me, I stood trembling. And he said to me, fear not, Daniel, for from the first day that you did set your heart to understand and to chasten yourself before God, your words were heard. Didn't take 3 weeks of fasting for God to hear him. That's an interesting statement. He said, we heard you the first day. But the prince of the kingdom of Persia withstood me for 21 days, 3 solid weeks. He kept him out of there. You have to understand, the prince of the kingdom of Persia apparently is another spirit being who had jurisdiction over Persia, which is where Daniel was. He was inside the jurisdiction of that spirit. And I gather that this angel had to fight his way in order to speak to Daniel at all. He says, the prince of the kingdom of Persia withstood me 21 days. Lo, Michael, one of the chief princes, came to help me, and I remained there with the kings of Persia. Now I'm come to make you understand what's going to happen in the latter days. Now, the prophecies are all very interesting. This part is tossed off as an aside, but what it reveals to us is that there's a spirit world which you and I don't see, and it's a good thing we don't, because we can sleep at night not seeing some of the things that are going on possibly in that world. But there are battles apparently that are being fought. For him, he had to fight his way past this great spirit being. You can visualize Star Wars type laser swords and so forth, but I have no idea what kind of a fight this was. All I know is there was one. And it took two of them to get one of them past, with the other one still there holding him up, fighting him, while Gabriel, I think this was, came on down to see Daniel to give him the word that was sent to him. When you read these things, you think, What is this world like out there in the part of the world that we can't see? And he goes on to say in verse 20, he says, you know why I've come to you now? Now I will return to fight with the prince of Persia. And when I am gone forth, lo, the prince of Grecia shall come. But I will show you what is noted in the scripture of truth. And there is none that holds with me in these things but Michael, your prince. Fascinating. Really fascinating. It just gives you this little window into what's going on in that world, and then closes the window again so you and I can sit here wondering and reminded of a scene in one movie I saw. It's just better that we don't know, that we can get on with our lives, that we can go to our jobs and play with our children, have a good time. There's some stuff in this universe that we are just better off not knowing. But this stuff does break through with us, upon us from time to time. In Mark chapter 9, there is a particular instance of one. Mark chapter 9, verse 17. One of the multitude answered and said, Master, I have brought unto you my son who has a dumb spirit. Wherever he takes him, he tears him, and he foams and gnashes with his teeth and pines away. I spoke to your disciples that they would cast him out, but they could not do it. And Jesus answered and said, O faithless generation, how long am I going to be with you? How long am I going to suffer you? Bring him to me. So they brought him, and when he, that is the boy, saw Jesus, straightway the spirit tore him, and he fell on the ground and wallowed, foaming. He asked the father, how long is it ago since this came unto him? And he said, of a child. Of a child. And you just have to wonder, why would that be so? How is it possible for it to be so? And my answer, I don't know. All I know that it is. There's a very real spirit world, and that spirit will does occasionally break through in different ways, and as often as not, it breaks through into children. Which is why God gives children parents and adults and teachers and aunts and uncles and what have you to look after them, to watch over them, to protect them, pray for them, and to hopefully keep some of these things from ever coming upon them. How does it happen? I don't know. But if this could happen to this child, then it doesn't stretch my imagination when I hear in the Psalms that the wicked go astray as soon as they are born speaking lies. And I have to understand that this isn't something that happens in this world just because some human being decides he'll go this way or that way, that there is an influence in this world, that there is power in this world that you and I can't reach up and touch on our own. We just can't. We've got to have help. Revelation chapter 12. There was war in heaven. Michael and his angels fought against the dragon, and the dragon fought and his angels and prevailed not. Neither was their place found any more in heaven. Look at this. See, you've got war going on in heaven. How do they fight? What are their weapons? How does this go about? I have no idea. The great dragon was cast out, that old serpent called the devil and Satan who deceives the whole world. He was cast out into the earth, and his angels were cast out with him. And I heard a loud voice saying in heaven, now is come salvation and strength and the kingdom of our God and the power of his Christ. For the accuser of our brethren is cast down, which accused them before God day and night. They overcame him by the blood of the Lamb and by the word of their testimony, and they loved not their lives unto the death. They overcame him. And so when you understand that little thing right there, that we can win, we actually can win, but we can't do it on our own. We can't do it on our own strength. I mean, an archangel couldn't handle the prince of Persia by himself. He had to have help. What makes us think that we can do it on our own? We overcome him by the blood of the Lamb, by the word of our testimony, and we must not love our lives unto the death. Therefore rejoice, you heavens, and you that dwell in them. Woe to the inhabitants of the earth and of the sea, for the devil is come down to you, having great wrath, because he knows he has but a short time. It's hard for me to account any other way for the persistent presence of evil in the world than that this poisonous weed is here that just continually comes up in every generation, in every circumstance. You think you've stamped it out. You think you put it on trial. You think you took the perpetrators out and hanged them. But the real perpetrators are not subject to any rope that we can put around their neck. When you read the Bible and you come across the words, the wicked, realize you are dealing with something inexpressibly evil, something that is in its raw form absolutely irredeemable, something that can only be dealt with by complete destruction. And don't let yourself be timid if you ever have to deal with it. And whatever you do, don't try to deal with it on your own authority.